From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The new Congress, the deficit, and the Pentagon. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. John Boehner was sworn in as House Speaker today, leading a Republican majority pledged to cut $100 billion from next year's budget. The Pentagon makes up more than half the spending that could be reduced, but cuts in the Defense Department are off the table. Even the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says the deficit is a threat to national security. Others regard the Pentagon as a paradigm of government waste. Why is it immune from the cost-cutting voters have asked for? Will the Tea Party make a difference? We'll look at the prospects. On Reporter's Notebook later on, Mark Twain and the N-word. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The new House majority wants to reduce federal spending, and every commission on the deficit has called for cuts at the Pentagon. So why are they off the table? How much could be saved without endangering national security? On Reporter's Notebook, new editions of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn have been edited to eliminate the N-word. Will that make them more accessible to contemporary readers? Does it distort America's racist past? First, this news update. Republican John Boehner has been elected Speaker of the House of Representatives. Democrat Nancy Pelosi now leads the minority. She passed the gavel to him just a few moments ago. Michael Crowley is the national correspondent for Time Magazine. And Michael, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren. Good to be here.
We have producers Gamely trying to find to listen to Boehner's speech and see if we can find a substantive portion of it before we end this segment. In the meantime, it really takes him a long time to do this, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of pomp and circumstance, but you know the parties savor it. Changing hands in the House is a tremendous deal. You get a big megaphone in the political arena. A lot of new chairmanships, a lot of new staff. Jobs. So the incoming majority is always very excited and they want to savor the moment.
Well, the outcoming minority, I don't know quite how to say that, but in any case, Nancy Pelosi, when she spoke before Boehner, also gave a lengthy speech about what she regarded as the accomplishments of the last Congress, something, of course, that the Republicans have vowed to change.
Right. Well, you know, Democrats are, particularly in the House, they take a kind of stubborn pride in what they did. And to some degree, I think Pelosi and the House Democrats feel that they went out on a limb and sometimes the Senate sawed it off and that they were the bold and courageous ones, you know, on health care and climate change, financial regulatory reform, and that, you know, that they did some of the heavier lifting. And so they go out really not in a very apologetic mood. They feel that it was the economy that cost them their majority and not, as the Republicans say, their substantive agenda. Now in come the Republicans, really with, you know, facing the dilemma of a base, you know, we sort of label them as the Tea Partiers, who expect them to undo all the things that Democratic Congress was able to achieve in the Obama administration so far. But really, Republicans have very limited power because the Senate is still controlled by Democrats, and it takes a lot of votes to override a presidential veto, even if you can get something through the House and Senate. And just for starters, repealing health care reform is almost certainly not going to happen. It's going to be really frustrating and hard for John Boehner to explain that back to Republican activists in the hinterlands.
Interesting point you made about the Senate, too. If the House Democrats are unhappy about the way the Senate behaved last year, now the Senate becomes their only defense if the Republicans in the House pass measures that overturn health care reform or finance reform or other things the Democrats did. The only way they have to prevent them from getting to the White House is the Senate.
That's right. So, you know, Harry Reid's role remains very critical. But, you know, worth reiterating that even if you have some issues where, you know, maybe moderate conservative Senate Democrats side with Republicans, and so there, you might have some things that pass the House and squeak through the Senate with the help of some Democrats who may be worried about their own skins if they think the political mood is remaining conservative and they might be in jeopardy in their reelection campaigns. There are actually a lot of senators like that who fit that bill. The president does still have that veto pen, and it does require two-thirds votes in both chambers to override his vetoes. I think you could really count, Warren, almost on one finger, the number of veto overrides that one could imagine coming in the next couple of years. I think there will be precious few. So what we're going to see now is a lot of symbolism and, you know, at the same time, some deal-making where the president is going to have to, you know, find some common ground with Republicans because, you know, you got to get a budget passed through both chambers of Congress. So you can't ignore the Republican House entirely if you are the White House right now.
Of course, deal-making is something that is antithetical to the Republican base, which you mentioned before. Yes. So then they were outraged at the passage of the even though the Bush tax cuts were extended, they were outraged about that bill because it increased unemployment benefits and did other things as well that they thought were real compromises by the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a sense among conservatives that, wow, we just had this election. We came out of it, you know, sort of holding all the cards, they thought, controlling Washington, having totally changed the game. And then suddenly President Obama got a lot of pretty good accomplishments. And his approval rating now in the last Gallup survey I saw was over 50% for the first time in several months. I think the president's getting a little bit of a bump. This is not what conservatives who, you know, turned out in big numbers for these Republican candidates in the fall were expecting. And this is going to be a continued dilemma for John Boehner, who I think understands that there's going to have to be some measure of compromise, in part for the reasons we just described. Boehner does not have a magic wand. He does not have unlimited power. He's going to have to take a quarter loaf or an eighth of a loaf here and there. But I'll just, you know, my last point is that I was at a Tea Party rally on the eve of the election. It was a Christine O'Donnell event in Delaware. And I talked to some voters there, some very conservative Tea Partiers. They don't expect, they're not going to be happy with compromise. They don't really want to hear about limited Republican control and getting what you can. They expect big change quickly, and they're going to be upset if they don't see it.
Okay, Michael Crowley, a national correspondent for Time Magazine. Thanks, as always, for being on our program.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
In a moment, the new Congress, the deficit, and the Pentagon on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. In his farewell speech, warning about the military-industrial complex, President and former Army General Dwight Eisenhower said that defense spending has to be weighed in the balance along with every other national program. The new House majority wants to cut $100 billion from next year's budget, but the Pentagon won't be subject to major reductions. Hendrik Hertzberg is a senior editor and a staff writer for New Yorker magazine. Thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
How is it that the Defense Department has come to be immune from the kind of cutting that the Republicans say they want to make and which they claim the voters mandated in last year's elections?
Well, the interesting thing about that Eisenhower quote that you mentioned is that he said it at the very end of his administration when he was on the way out the door. He didn't say it earlier when he might have been able to do something about it. And it's, of course, only gotten much, much worse from there. And we're at kind of a standstill on this subject. There are some Republicans who have breathed heretical words about looking at the defense budget. But basically, the fear of being thought soft on defense is paralyzing all across the board.
Are you suggesting, by pointing out that Eisenhower didn't say that till the end of his administration, that he was worried about being called soft on defense?
No, he wasn't. Of course, he wasn't. He was speaking from his experience in fighting this military-industrial complex, in resisting it. He was in a position to resist it. He really didn't have to go over the heads of Congress to the public to restrain military spending, but he was a unique figure. It's a little like right now, if General Petraeus were president and he were calling for reductions in the military budget, that would be politically doable. But General Petraeus is not president.
You said that some Republicans have uttered these heretical words, let's cut the Pentagon. Who are they, and how much of a cut have they proposed?
Well, there's Ron Paul's. There's Ron Paul and his son, the newly elected senator, Rand Paul, who he uttered a few of these words until he got the nomination, and then he stopped uttering them. But there are the Budget Commission that Obama appointed, which include some Republicans. They talked about reducing the defense budget, or at least constraining somewhat the increases in the defense budget. That's what it usually that's what these proposals usually amount to.
So it's not the only deficit commission that has recommended that. Most of them have said that we ought to focus on the Pentagon. But you're saying only in terms of increases, not in in real substantive reductions.
Well, they might involve real. Yes, they would involve real substantive reductions as the cost of other military programs increases. It's just that right now, for purely political reasons, you have the Republicans ruling military spending out of bounds in their talk of cutting the budget, and that, at least to me, it looks like what they're trying to do is set up the Democrats, protect themselves, and set up the Democrats to be to force them to be the ones who bring up the forbidden topic, and then they can be accused of being pro-terrorist and soft on defense and all the rest.
Sort of the Nixon to China argument. Hendrik Hertzberg, again, senior editor, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. We heard earlier on our program, we've heard many times, that the base of the Republican majority, the constituents, particularly the Tea Party people, really want to see cuts in the budget. Chris Littleton is head of Ohio Liberty Council. That's a statewide coalition of 58 Tea Party groups. I would point out that the new speaker comes from Ohio. Chris Littleton, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be back.
What's your take on the Pentagon? Are you, as a Tea Party leader, somebody who thinks that these are not heretical words, but that the Pentagon ought to be cut?
The Pentagon has to be cut. Not should be, it must be. It's one of those top four budget items that if you're sitting down with your family and you're reviewing where you can cut and you've found a lot of discretionary areas and you're not going out to eat and you still can't afford a mortgage, you're going to have to get a new house. This is one of those types of things. It is a fundamental necessity to cut defense spending. It's not a possibility. It must be done. It's too big. There's too much money, and we don't have any other choices.
You and others who want to see the government reduced, though, say that one of its very legitimate functions is protecting the national security. Are you not worried about that if the Pentagon gets cut?
Well, let's take a very practical look at foreign policy. Effectively, we still feel like we're fighting the Korean War. Why do we need people in 140 different countries in order to appropriately protect? I want sovereign borders as much as anybody does, and I want to make sure that the country is protected. But at some point, when is the tens of billions of dollars that's spent overseas a good return on our investment? I don't think it is. I mean, I think that's playing out in terms of world policy. And the way that the global economy is going. At some point, the economic stability of the nation is far better for us and the world than is the military might and the ability to play world police, which I think we have no business doing. So let's get out of the world police business, and I think our economic strength would be far more beneficial to the world than would military might.
You represent 58 Tea Party groups in Ohio. Do you think that this is generally a sentiment that other Tea Partiers would agree with?
No. This is, I think, a split issue for a lot of people in the Tea Party. There are those like myself who would advocate for a significant shrinking of the Department of Defense, and there are others that say no. That is a source of stability. That's something that's absolutely necessary. So no, this is definitely not a monolithic issue for Tea Party people. There's a pretty significant divide on it, and I think that comes down to you have some Tea Party people that are generally more friendly with the Republican Party, and then some Tea Party people that are a little bit more I guess based in ideology, more like I am.
Hendrik Hertzberg, let me go back to you with The New Yorker magazine. Interesting that Chris Littleton says there's a real split among the Tea Partiers. What's that going to mean for the kind of pressure on Congress that Chris Littleton would like to see in favor of cutting defense spending?
Well, it does offer a modicum of hope that that over time something interesting might develop here. It really does. I'd hate to, I suppose, I feel it's a little unusual for me to be agreeing with a Tea Party leader. But I do think he's right about the need to cut the defense budget. But I don't think it's because we don't have the money. I think it's because I think the money should be spent, but it should just be spent on other things outside the defense budget. It's that our defense establishment, as Chris noted, is structured to meet is structured to a world that no longer exists. And we have immense numbers of programs that are designed to face down the Soviet bloc and the Warsaw Pact. And there is no more Soviet bloc, and there is no more Warsaw Pact. Yet we have this immense establishment, which is politically very powerful, which is economically very powerful, and we need to shift resources away from that. It's a lot of that spending is entirely wasteful and does not address any of our actual national security needs, which are much, much different from what they were before the end of the Cold War.
Chris Littleton with the Ohio Liberty Council, I assume that you would not agree with Hendrik Hertzberg, as he indicated, with the idea that the money ought to be spent someplace else.
Yeah, I want to see a complete reduction in all levels of spending. And I think that's something that, you know, when you say the Republicans have to come to grips with what they're willing to cut in defense, and it's huge. I mean, that number is just so big. It's somewhere north of, I think, $700 billion budget the Department of Defense sits on now. Well, you know, on the other side of the coin for me is that, you know, if it's good in one place, it's good in another. So we have to look at significant reductions in Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, because really, if you're not dealing with those four, you're not looking at the money crisis, the financial crisis in the government, its own solvency, seriously. You have to consider these really large programs. And so, yeah, I'd like to see all of them cut, not just defense, but all of them.
Okay, Chris Littleton, leading a statewide coalition in Ohio of 58 Tea Party groups. William Hartung is director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. He's author of the book Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. That's out this week. Good to have you on our program.
Yes, good to be here.
Tell us, if you will, what percentage of spending is the Pentagon responsible for, and very particularly the so-called discretionary spending, which can actually be cut?
Well, it's about a quarter of the total budget, including Social Security and Medicare. If you just look at discretionary spending, where most of the focus has been in terms of cuts, it's 56 cents on the dollar, which is why, you know, as pointed out by our friend from Ohio, you can't really cut the budget if you don't deal with military spending.
How would you account for the fact that all of this budget cutting that we've heard talked about doesn't include the Pentagon?
Well, I think Hendrik Hertzberg put part of the issue out there, which is that there is a fear of being viewed as soft on defense. I think that has to be transformed. I mean, basically, throwing money at defense does not make us safer. If it's going into waste, fraud, and abuse, if it's going into 700 military bases that we don't need, if it's going to things like the F-22 fighter plane, a plane that was never actually engaged in combat, there's a lot of places where things could be cut. And I think somebody needs to stand up as some of these leaders and say, you know, a strong defense does not mean the most expensive defense possible.
Hendrik Hertzberg said there's a risk at all times of being called soft on defense if you advocate cuts in the Pentagon. What about other sort of mechanical reasons for this, such as the presence of defense contractors in the districts of important members of Congress?
Well, that's a huge factor. And if you look at the new Congress, Buck McKeon, who's going to head the House Armed Services Committee, his two top contributors are Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, and both of them have facilities in his district. So he's going to fight tooth and nail to keep military spending at the highest level possible, as is Daniel Inouye, the Democrat head of the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, who also has defense contractors as his top campaign contributors and has their facilities also in his state. So that's something that would have to be broken through if we're going to make progress on this.
There's a piece out now on CNN Money by Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He has did serve as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He says you could cut $5 billion out of the Pentagon budget and still not have an impact on national security. Is that order of magnitude reasonable from your point of view?
I think we could. You know, I'm part of a task force with Mr. Korb, and we did a 10-year projection of cutting $1 trillion over 10 years, about $100 billion a year. which coincidentally the $100 billion is exactly the amount that the Republican leadership has said they want to cut from the social safety net. So I think the money's there. It's just, I think it's political will, and it's changing the public perception of what reasonable defense spending really is.
I just want to remind our listeners what we're talking about here, that we're speaking as the new Congress is being sworn in, and they are advocating cuts across the board. Here's the majority leader, Eric Cantor, speaking. We don't have Eric Cantor. I thought we did. What he said yesterday was that everything's on the table. Everybody's going to have to do more with less. But Hendrik Hertzberg, back to you with The New Yorker. That is not does not seem to be the case.
It doesn't seem to be the case. And politically, it's hard to see that happening. But again, there is this slight stirring on the right, and Chris Littleton is representative of it. Some of it is hooked very strongly into a sort of a libertarian isolationism, and that's kind of the Ron Paul wing. But some of it is also based on what I was talking about earlier, namely the fact that so much of the defense establishment is tilting at a windmill that isn't there anymore. The windmill labeled the Soviet bloc. But again, this problem of the political clout of the military-industrial complex of these jobs is enormous. And if we cut those, you know, that in a way, you know, that's all stimulative spending. That's all jobs for the boys. And if somehow it could be married to other ways of finding jobs for the boys, it might have a ghost of a chance.
Oh, not just jobs for the boys, which I assume you mean to combat soldiers, but William Hartung, we're talking about a lot of other jobs, too, if the kind of defense projects that you mentioned earlier, the F-35 and others, are cut back. I guess the Navy wants $13 billion for a new aircraft carrier. The Pentagon itself says we should reduce the number we have now from 11 to 10, but then there'd be nobody making a new aircraft carrier.
Well, that's right, and people at places like Newport News, Virginia, would be, up in arms. I think, you know, one thing is military spending is the least effective form of stimulus. Almost anything else you spend money on would create more jobs. So the question is, can you find a way to put money into infrastructure, into things like green manufacturing that would create some alternatives, or at least get the economy moving again so that there's options for people that they don't have to cling to these jobs as the only alternative. And I think that's very difficult in this climate, but I think over the next 3 to 5 years, between the deficit pressures and I think some more creative policymaking, we could see reductions in defense.
William Hartung, again, author of Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, a book out this week. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll continue this conversation afterwards on Reporter's Notebook, Mark Twain and the N-Word. Tell us what you think on our To the Point Facebook page. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Since we began our program, John Boehner, the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, has begun and ended his first address as Speaker to the House of Representatives. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
What they want is a government that's honest, accountable, and responsive to their needs. A government that respects individual liberty, honors our heritage, and bows before the public that it serves. Let's start with the rules package that the House will consider today. If passed, it will change how this institution operates, with an emphasis on real transparency, greater accountability, and a renewed focus on our Constitution.
Again, John Boehner with some of the priorities that he hopes to emphasize as the new speaker of the House of Representatives. We're meantime talking about the fact that the Pentagon has been made immune of the cuts in spending that the Republicans have said they want to implement. Stephen Walt is academic dean and professor of international affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And Stephen Walt, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here.
Now, let me ask you the same question I've asked the others, and get your take on what you have referred to as a remarkable consensus on foreign policy at a time of great partisan differences and in Washington. How do you explain it?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons for it. I mean, we do have this bizarre situation, as the other speakers have alluded to, where the United States is currently spending more on defense than the rest of the world put together. And even though it has no great power rivals, it has no enemies nearby, we spend about six times more than the number two power, which is now China. And by the way, we also have thousands of nuclear weapons, et cetera, et cetera. We could devastate sort of any adversary. And yet we seem to have a quite strong bipartisan consensus that this situation ought to continue pretty much indefinitely. I think there are a variety of reasons for it. You know, Americans want to be secure. The military is now a highly respected institution. You see that in the fact that politicians on both sides of the aisle have to sort of ritually talk about how they support the troops, regardless of what the troops are actually doing. And then finally, I think we have essentially a foreign policy establishment now where the range of opinion tends to run the gamut from A to B, where there is still a quite considerable consensus within the sort of beltway foreign policy world, that it's America's both responsibility and obligation to manage much of the world. And if you're going to do that, you're going to have to spend a lot of money to prepare the capabilities to try and accomplish that. Now, it doesn't always work out particularly well, as we're seeing in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. But I don't think you actually can cut the defense budget in a significant way if you're not willing to sort of ask some questions about what America's global role is. You're not going to be able to do as many of the things that we've been doing for the last 30 or 40 years without continuing to spend a lot of money. Fortunately, I agree with some of the other speakers here that you could cut a substantial fraction of what we're doing and not do some of the foolish things we've done in the last decade or two and still be just as secure and far better off than we've been.
How much could we cut, do you think? Let's start with the $100 billion that the Republicans say they want to take out of the budget. How much could the Pentagon provide without there being a threat to national defense?
Well, one way to think about that is to think that we spend a little over $700 billion a year now on national security. China spends, if you add it all up, somewhere around $140 billion. Now, if you took $100 billion right out of the Pentagon, you did that intelligently, you didn't just do it across the board, you would still have the United States spending four to five times more than the number two power. And remember, a lot of the other major military countries in the world are American allies, countries like Japan, countries like Germany, countries like Great Britain. So, in fact, our security situation is even better than the raw numbers indicate. In other words, you take $100 billion out and you don't suddenly have a United States that's disarmed. You don't have the United States suddenly facing an imbalance of power against us. You actually have a United States that's still in a remarkably favorable security position vis-a-vis any possible combination of adversaries.
Stephen Walt again at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Back to William Hartung, author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, and director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. We don't have the draft anymore, but anybody who was drafted, as I was at one point in my life, knows that there's an enormous amount of waste in the Pentagon just on a day-to-day basis, not just in the buying of massive weapons systems. What about that? And hasn't even the Secretary of Defense conceded that and indicated himself that he could cut at least $100 billion out of the Pentagon budget?
Well, yes, Secretary of Defense Gates is looking for waste, but unfortunately he wants to take whatever he gets and put it back into procurement and research and development. So at most, under his plan, we'd see a slowing of the growth of military spending rather than actual reduction. So I think there's waste to be had. Sometimes it's hard to ferret out, and I think sometimes people overstate the amounts you can get. I think, as was mentioned, at some point you have to look at what your foreign policy is if you really want to make major changes.
But it's true, is it not, that there's no audit of the Defense Department?
It has not been auditable for many years. And without that audit, of course, you don't know where the bodies are buried. You don't know exactly how much waste is in there. And the Government Accountability Office has complained about this year after year after year, basically telling us that the Pentagon is probably the least accountable agency of the entire federal government.
How did it become unauditable?
Well, I think it, you know, it's partly because nobody ever asked. I mean, it was sort of given the sacrosanct position in the budget. And also, you know, in recent years, they've reduced the number of auditors within the department. They've reduced the number of contract officers that are overseeing all the spending. In some cases, they actually hire private companies to do the auditing, to do the oversight of companies that they may even have business relationships with. So in a sense, it's been a political decision, and it's been kind of just, you know, bureaucratic laziness in a way.
Stephen Walt, back to you at Harvard. You have written about the power of bad ideas, or the ability of bad ideas to keep coming back and to be repeated even after they have been demonstrated as incorrect, the domino theory that was so popular during Vietnam, one of the things that you've pointed to. Can you elaborate a little bit on how you think that works and how it's relevant to what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's relevant in some ways. First of all, when you're a really powerful, wealthy country like the United States is, you can afford to be pretty stupid. You don't have to get a lot of things right, and you'll still be okay. You'll pay a price for it. But I think one of the consequences, one of the reasons we have a lot of excess on the foreign policy and defense policy front is that at some level we can afford it, and you push this all off to either people who want to hold American bonds or to subsequent generations. The second reason is that we actually don't have a particularly lively debate anymore on national security questions, as I was indicating before. I think that's partly because fewer and fewer Americans actually serve in the military. We have an all-volunteer force now. Most politicians actually don't have military experience. Many academics aren't really interested in security affairs anymore. And that means the debate in Washington tends to be dominated either by politicians or by think tanks, many of whom get various amounts of money from companies like Lockheed Martin. And even though, you know, they, I think, are doing, they think they're giving us honest analysis, there is a sense that there's a thumb on the scale here. You don't have an equally well-funded, equally well-established network of people who take a somewhat more skeptical view of this. Now, if you have a situation like that, then if we're following the wrong policies, or if we have people who aren't making very good decisions, it's going to be harder to hold them accountable. We're not going to learn as quickly. And I think you see that actually pretty clearly in both the decision to go into Iraq and now the decisions to escalate the war in Afghanistan. War in Afghanistan is costing us $100 billion or so a year right now. If you wanted to save $100 billion, one way to do that would be to get out of Afghanistan sooner rather than later. But that, of course, is not the direction the Republican Party has pushed, and that's not the direction that the Obama administration has taken. Again, it's a sign of, I think, that consensus that it's our job to get out there and run everything.
William Hartung, back to you. Is it the result of that consensus, or is it the fact that it is perceived, particularly since September 11th, that we really do face a threat, even from Afghanistan?
Well, I think there is that perception. You know, I think, you know, Afghanistan at the level it's being fought now really has kind of gotten off track in terms of the way to deal with terrorism. You know, I think law enforcement, intelligence, various other ways of going at it, have a lot more prospect of success than using, you know, tens of thousands of boots on the ground. But I think that initial sense that Afghanistan was, quote-unquote, the good war, which President Obama has perpetuated, I think is probably still in a lot of people's minds. Although, if you ask people now, it's getting to be about a 50-50 split or so about whether people think we should be in there for the long or even the medium haul.
Chris Littleton, back to you. The Ohio Liberty Council, a coalition of 58 Tea Party groups in that state. What's your take on the threats that America faces and how it is that the country can be protected?
Yeah, there are real threats out there. I agree with a lot of what's being said right now. One of the guys alluded to that's an interesting thing, that I'm agreeing with Tea Party leaders. There's a common sense perspective to this, that our trajectory on foreign policy is just completely wrong. And so you have a State Department and a Department of Defense who have no incentive to change at this point. It perpetuates the bureaucracy that is jobs, that is influence, that is power in D.C., and who wants to change that? I mean, there's very little incentive to change something once it's been institutionalized to the point that it is now. So I think we have to rethink what foreign policy is. And I'll play, you know, cliche Tea Party geek just a little bit for a moment and go back to our founding fathers didn't really envision a type of standing military that we have now. They didn't envision us having a foot in something near 150 countries with permanence. You have to protect trade routes. You have to protect economic interests. Everybody knows that. But when we're seeking political outcomes or even moral outcomes at times, and that's what drives our foreign policy, well, hey, where were we on Rwanda? Where were we on the Sudan? Or arguably, you could say that the U.S. has contributed to what ended up being the global war on terror because we were in places like Somalia doing things that, you know, Osama bin Laden himself wrote that he had a pretty significant problem with and was one of the impetus behind why he got involved in things. Well, what if we had never been there? What if our foreign policy did not dictate us trying to meddle in every single country's business through military intervention or foreign aid?
Hendrik Hertzberg,
the trajectory is completely off. It's just completely off, and now, again, it just perpetuates its own existence.
Let me go back to Hendrik Hertzberg. You said that people like Chris Littleton provide, even for you, a modicum of hope that something might change. How many people in the Congress do you think, the new members, might be sympathetic to the kind of idea that he is suggesting?
Well, I think probably a good 15 to 20% of the Republican members, and probably a considerably larger proportion of the Democratic members. I think what you're seeing, what you may see, is the reverse of what we've been talking about. Namely, you look at what our defense needs are, and you see that they don't correspond to what we're spending. We're spending differently and more than we need to for our defense needs. If you start with the idea that we've got to spend less, that can lead you to re-examine the premises of foreign policy instead of looking at the premises and going toward the spending. It does open your mind. If you're worried about the spending, it's logical then for you to open your mind to new ways of looking at foreign policy and for re-examining the assumptions of foreign policy, many of which are really no longer reality-based, but are based on an existing infrastructure that seeks to perpetuate itself, quite understandably.
One of our listeners in a market where this program runs live has emailed us an interesting question, and that is, what about the cost of private security contractors now working for the government? It's my understanding that in Iraq, I believe, they may outnumber the American military presence there. William Hartung, what about that? How much of a cost is that, and is it part of the Pentagon, or is it divided by the Pentagon and other departments?
Well, a lot of it is in the Pentagon budget, but it's in operations and maintenance, which is this huge category, which is not very well broken down. So I think it falls into that inauditable category. You do also have the State Department spending money on this, so it's across agencies, and it's, you know, certainly in the tens of billions of dollars per year, but I don't think anybody knows exactly how much, and it's broken down between, you know, gun toters, rebuilders, people who provide logistics for the troops. And if you add up all those categories, yes, it would add up to, you know, close to or more than the number of troops we deploy in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan.
But then again, without an audit, it's really difficult to know what the total might be or how it might compare to the rest of the spending.
Well, we had $5 billion disappear in Iraq, and nobody has yet given us a good explanation of where that all went. We even have smaller projects like the Commander's Emergency Response Program, which was written up in the Washington Post recently, where they're doing things like trying to build water parks. They're walking around the street handing out cash to warlords, all of which under the slogan of money is a weapon. But I think the way they're using it, it's going to make us more of a laughingstock than intimidating force.
Stephen Walt, back to you at the Kennedy School at Harvard. Are you optimistic that we may see any positive change, or are we looking at something that is one of these ongoing conditions that we'll simply have to deal with for a long time to come?
I think there's going to have to be adjustments here. I mean, I wouldn't go perhaps as far as Mr. Littleton would in cutting things, but the fact is the United States has been living beyond its means for quite some time, and there are some challenges. I mean, I do think we're going to start seeing a more open debate because the composition of Congress is changing, and in some respects, there are competing interests here at home that are going to demand to be heard as well. I've occasionally joked that the biggest threat to defense spending is actually the AARP, and the baby boomers who are going to expect actually to get many of the entitlements that they've long anticipated. And they're a pretty well-educated group, and they're going to be quite vocal about wanting those things. And that's going to put real pressure on the Pentagon and upon other forms of spending, and we're going to have to make various hard choices. I think that's virtually inevitable.
So we're all seem to be agreeing here that the deficit needs to be dealt with, that the Pentagon has to be involved in the reductions because it's such a huge part of federal spending. Stephen Walt, what if it isn't? What if the current situation continues for years to come?
Then I think you're going to see the United States quite paradoxically become substantially weaker over time, because we're going to be spending money on things we don't need, and we're not going to be investing in infrastructure here at home. We're going to be starving education. State and local governments are going to be paring things. Americans will be living less well, and we're not going to be substantially safer. I mean, one of the great illusions that I think Americans have fallen for is that there's something inherently wrong with paying taxes in order to spend money on things here at home, but it's patriotic to pay taxes in order to spend money on things all over the world. I think that's something that a habit of mind we got into during the Cold War, and it's going to take a generation for that to clear itself out of our collective consciousness, but I think it ultimately will.
Chris Littleton, back to you with the Ohio Liberty Council. You want to cut everything, but what about the patriotism involved in maintaining services to people who need them here in the United States?
You know, I'm this is a bit of a personal story, but it answers the question. I'm the son of someone who was in the Air Force for 26 years. And so I lived this. I lived on military bases. I traveled around to different places, even overseas with my father. My father, as a, you know, someone who's pretty freshly out of the military, one of the first people to tell you how many problems there are and how big this thing has become. I think there's a practicality of life to this, that when you sit down with someone, you have a very serious conversation, we can all acknowledge we're not in a sustainable position. It's very much a dollars and cents argument to a certain extent. So lying all intentions aside, we have to deal with this as if it was a math problem. And this is one piece in a puzzle. It just happens to be a larger piece than most. So I think that patriotism, I consider my father one of the most patriotic people that I know, and serving for 26 years proved that. He didn't have to stay. He did, because he wanted to stay. I would call him no less patriotic for having a desire to shrink military than I would consider myself any less patriotic. So, no, it's not part of the equation. I mean, this is mathematical reality, and that's really all this is.
We're going to have to end the program there. Thank you all so much for being on it. Chris Littleton, head of the Ohio Liberty Council, statewide coalition of 58 Tea Party groups. Hendrik Hertzberg, senior editor, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. William Hartung at the New America Foundation, his book, The Prophets of War. Lockheed Martin in the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And Stephen Walt, academic dean, professor of international affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Many thanks to all of you once again. Mark Twain's autobiography became a bestseller last year, but there's been an uproar over new publications of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. Does replacing the N-word make them accessible to more readers, or is it censorship that distorts the realities of 19th century America? More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
Norman Elney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In Mark Twain's classic Huckleberry Finn, the N-word appears no less than 219 times. But in an upcoming edition to be published by New South Books in Alabama, it doesn't appear at all. It's been replaced by the word slave. Peniel Joseph is professor of history at Tufts University. He's author of Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, a narrative history of black power in America, and also of Dark Days, Bright Nights, from Black Power to Barack Obama. Professor Joseph, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
A lot of people are outraged about this change, fiddling with a classic of literature and sanitizing Mark Twain, is the way some people put it, with political correctness. What's your take?
Well, I see there's a couple of ways to look at this. I think in terms of trying to teach Mark Twain, especially Huck Finn, in high schools and below, it's always been really a tough thing to do, because the N-word is used so many times. I would argue that most high school teachers and even some college professors are not necessarily equipped
to provide the historical context for white and black students, to make the class feel comfortable, and to really, even if you're going to read that term, how do you read it out loud? Do you have white kids read it out loud? Can the English teacher read it out loud? So at times, teaching that book, if people aren't prepared to sort of explain why the N-word is used throughout that book, it can be really something that's very, very oppressive for African-American students. At the same time, the whole idea of sort of sanitizing it and acting like the text didn't use the N-word and just used the replace it with the word slave, it can be a historical decontextualization. So we as a scholar, you want the word in there, and you don't want the text to be played with. But then when we're thinking pedagogically for our students who are reading Mark Twain, I would say that you'd have to really plow very deep ground to teach that word and have kids in class say the N-word, dozens and dozens of times. You're talking about 219 times. 13, 14, 15, and 16-year-olds say this.
There's a very interesting quote in an article in the New York Times about this by a school teacher, an English teacher at South Mountain High School in Arizona, Elizabeth Absher. And she says, "I'm not offended by anything in Huck Finn. I'm a big fan of Mark Twain, and I hear a lot worse in the hallway in front of my class."
Yeah, I thought, I read that quote as well. I'd have to, I would disagree with that teacher in this sense. When black kids are saying the N-word, and we know there's been a sort of a long debate about this over the last 10, 15 years, and there's been books, the N-word, who can say it, who can't, and the hip-hop generation using that word, it's going to be a lot, their terminology and the way they're defining it is going to be in real stark contrast to the way it's being defined, in Huck Finn and the sort of the oppressive way it's being deployed. So I think just because you she might hear some of her students say it, it doesn't give her just complete license to say, okay, we're just going to read this and, the black kids in class be damned if she can't really provide a deep historical context for why we're using that term. And again, should we even read that term out loud? And if we do, how many times are we going to say it? And what's going to be the impact on really black and white students? At the same time, in terms of Huck Finn as a text, and if you're teaching college students, where I think by that point in a college lecture course there should be enough of a time and patience where you could explain that to students, yeah, you wouldn't want it sanitized. But even then, do students want to hear that word 219 times? Who can say it, who can't? So it is going to be complicated.
Don't they have to know, though, what the realities were in 19th century America? And isn't Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, to some extent as well, about racism?
No, absolutely. And I think that's why, as a scholar, you don't want the text toyed with. You don't want the text toyed with. What I would just say is that in terms of high school students, do we have a system set up? Because I remember in high school, reading Mark Twain and at times reading where people are, saying the N-word. Do we have something set up where this can be taught in a context where most high school English classes really don't have a deep conversation about race going on? Most high school history classes don't have a deep and substantive conversation about race going on. So that's the only concern. And is the right thing to do to sanitize it? I wouldn't say that's necessarily the right thing to do. I think he's adopting a strategy, and there's only 7,500 of these things that are being printed up. But I do think just going full bore and just constantly saying the N-word in the hopes of teaching young people about the brutalization of that time with no context is fomenting its own damage as well.
I want to end this program by just reading from what Mark Twain himself had to say when he was challenged about the coarseness and mischievous practices that were in his book. He says, "I wrote Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn for adults exclusively, and it's always distressed me when I find that boys and girls have been allowed access to them. The mind that becomes soiled in youth can never again be washed clean. I know this by my own experience, and to this day I cherish an unappeased bitterness against the unfaithful guardians of my young life, who not only permitted but compelled me to read an unexpurgated Bible before I was 15 years old. I let our listeners interpret that for themselves. Professor Peniel Joseph at Tufts University, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks, Rap.
A program produced today by Andrea Brody with Francis Anderton and Katie Cooper, our technical director, Wesley Roberts. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.